the worldwide audience that is obsessed with the sport is thinking about is the guys in the field, is the Messis and the Ronaldos and all the other stars, and they're not interested, you know, in the guys running the sport. And it's funny, it's just a weird duality. The guys running the sport probably like it that way because they can stay in the shadows and get all their money and live this incredible first class lifestyle, which really is quite spectacular, without you know, the fans really being any the wiser, because they're thinking about, as they should, about the players.
That's investigative journalist Ken Benzinger talking about corruption at FIFA, world football's governing body. And this is a World Cup themed episode of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back, one and all, to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. I'm Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host, your one and only host. This is the show where we go long form, examining all kinds of things using the lenses of risk and uncertainty with some fabulous guests. And we do this to learn how to embrace risk, how to make better decisions, and to understand our world just a little bit more. So let's get into it. This episode has been released right in the middle of a little known sporting event. You might have heard of it. It's called the World Cup, and it's being played right now in Russia. Now, you might love football, or you maybe call it soccer. You might revel in Lionel Messi's unbelievable skills or Cristiano Ronaldo's athleticism, although both have gone home now. You might enjoy the drama of the game, particularly the knockout stages of a World Cup. Perhaps you play the game. Perhaps your children do. Perhaps you are a fanatical supporter of your local club side or a major European side. Maybe these are one and the same. Conversely, you might not care about the sport at all. You might be sickened by the amount of money in it or the fact that people spend far too much time obsessing over football. Maybe, like me, you are all of these things at the same time. And regardless of where you sit in this spectrum, what is sometimes called the world's game, the people's game, or the beautiful game has a very dark side. It's a side that you should know about because it affects the world in which we live. And that dark side is corruption. And we talk about it in this episode. My guest is Ken Benzinger. Ken is an award-winning investigative journalist. He's worked at the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times. He's currently at BuzzFeed News. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's recently written a book called Red Card: FIFA and the Fall of the Most Powerful Men in Sports. Red Card is an enthralling account of the FBI's investigation into FIFA, the world's governing body for the sport of football slash soccer. And this is a book that shows the greed, arrogance, and self-interest of the men that ran FIFA, which effectively is the world's most powerful sporting institution, and how investigators brought this small cabal to justice. The book also shows how endemic corruption was and very plausibly still is within FIFA and the sport of football. It's a thrilling book that I just couldn't put it down. It's a story that is extremely relevant to us, not only because of the world of sport, but also to geopolitics. And we get into that and a lot more, including how the book came about, how FIFA's structure facilitates corruption, and why this has similarities to the way organized crime syndicates are structured, how the money flowed and how the corruption worked and maybe still works, how the US got involved in investigating FIFA, whether or not FIFA is any cleaner now, things that Ken is watching out for in Russia 2018, parallels to the Russia doping scandal in athletics. We touch on geopolitics, how the FIFA investigation made the Russia slash Trump investigation possible, risks to the sport, whether or not it's okay to watch the World Cup, given what we know, plans for a movie, and much, much more. This is a conversation that combines sport, current affairs, and culture, and I loved it. I hope you do too. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Ken Benziger. Ken, thank you for joining me on the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on, and it's very timely because the World Cup is going on as we speak. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to join you.
This book that you've written, Red Card, it is fabulous. It reads like a spy novel, like a thriller, and it's true and frightening and very, very interesting. And I just wanted to understand how you got involved in this in the first place.
Yeah, I am a an investigative journalist, and not specifically one who covers sports or sports governance. And most of the work I've done over my career is not oriented to sports, but I do like sports, and so every once in a while I'll dip my finger into sports stories. And in 2014, before the last World Cup, I wrote a big long profile of an American soccer official who had been enormously powerful in the sport, probably the most important and powerful American official in the history of international soccer, but who also was enormously corrupt. And this official, whose name was Chuck Blazer, had kind of escaped much public notice because he was American. Mm. Sort of a funny thing about the sport, which is it's just not very popular in the U.S. And as a result, no one had really spent time thinking about him, even despite his influence. And I wrote this profile of him, and there was lots of evidence out there, both me picking up information that had already been public, plus digging up new things to suggest that he had really run the sport like his own little fiefdom and made himself a lot of money. And then it ran, and I moved on to other pursuits and was working on a totally unrelated project with a colleague when a year later there were these massive raids of FIFA of a hotel in Zurich where FIFA executives were staying. They were arrested, and at that point we learned for the first time that the U.S. Department of Justice had been running a long-running secret investigation of corruption in the sport. What we also learned in very short order was that Chuck Blazer had been a central part of that investigation. He was a cooperator with the DOJ, and had helped the FBI, DOJ, and IRS build the case. And so suddenly this article I'd written seemed very prescient. And I always feel, as a journalist, that it's better to be lucky than good. And I think this is an instance of me being not really that prescient and much more just really lucky. But I suddenly found myself kind of with a definitive story about something that everyone at the time was talking about. Maybe people listening to this program will remember that in 2015, it was a different kind of news cycle, and the FIFA scandal was capturing headlines for days and days, if not weeks. It was all people were talking about, and so at that period of time, there was just a ton of interest in the story, and I had been wanting to do a book for a long time. This seemed like a great opportunity, and I leapt at it.
We'll get into some of the mechanics of how you did this story, because I think that's equally as interesting as the story itself. I'm fascinated by that. But you do a wonderful job of talking about FIFA in this book. And for me, one of the ways you really describe, and I want you to perhaps walk my listeners through how FIFA went from this really small organization that had, I think you describe it as an office in the second floor of above a restaurant or something in Zurich, to having these global headquarters with this sort of Dr. Doom boardroom table, and how that flipped and that coincided with the arrival of Sepp Blatter and commercial rights and things like this. And I'm just wondering if you could just walk the listeners through that to explain how this sort of led to everything that transpired after that.
Yeah, so I think it's FIFA's 114 year old organization now. It was founded in 1904 in Paris, and It was founded as an organization with the goal of unifying the rules of this sport, which was still relatively new, had been around for maybe 40 or 50 years at that point, and a very different era in terms of communication, transportation. You can imagine that the rules were slightly different from country to country, that while the basics of the sport might have been the same in France, they played it slightly different than they played it in Italy and in Belgium, et cetera, and in South America too. And so they created FIFA to try to unify the rules and also to allow teams from one country to play each other countries and on this, you know, so to speak, on a fair playing field. And that was the original intention of this sport. Some years later, they created the World Cup. In 1930 was the first World Cup, and that was created actually to compete with the Olympics, because the Olympics had already created a soccer tournament in their World Cup, and they wanted to compete with that. The World Cup turned out to be a really good idea, enormously successful, and, you know, became the main focal point of FIFA activities in terms of their calendar. But all the way up until the 1970s, FIFA was not an organization that made a lot of money. Most of its money came from ticket sales. It would sell tickets to the World Cup and a few other smaller events, and that's where the money would come from. And even with the advent of TV, for many years, they gave away the signal for free or for very small amounts of money. It wasn't until 1974 when all this changes. Well, 1974 is a really incredibly important moment in the history of the sport. This is when, for the first time ever, a non-European is elected president of FIFA. It's a Brazilian named João Avalanche. Mm. And this man comes and challenges the whole hegemony of FIFA, challenges the kind of tweedy gentleman's club feel of the organization, and says, you know, this is the sport that everyone loves, and more people should love it. And we need to bring this sport to the whole world and give everyone a chance to play it. And I want to bring soccer to South America, to Africa. I want to bring it to Asia. I want to bring it to the South Pacific. I want the whole world to play this sport. He was elected principally on that platform. And when he gets into power, he realizes almost immediately that he has a big problem, which is there's no money in the bank at FIFA to pay for this platform. I mean, getting the sport to sub-Saharan Africa, getting this sport to, you know, Sri Lanka or Vanuatu or wherever you want to get it, is very expensive, and they didn't have the money to do it. And so he's suddenly sort of panicked. I'm in trouble. I've written a check that I can't cash. And so that's when he turns, and this is this critical moment in the history of the sport, which leads to the corruption. That's when he turns to sponsors. That's when he is approached by two gentlemen, one of them from Adidas and one of them an advertising guy from London, who say, we can solve your financial woes. And the way we do it is by, you know, getting big multinational sponsors to support FIFA and plaster their name all over it and the World Cup and all its events. And Avalanche, who is a businessman and a lawyer, thinks this is a terrific idea. And they sign up Coca-Cola as the first Category 1 sponsor of FIFA. And then they get Adidas and they get other major brands to jump in. And pretty soon there's all these huge sponsors putting money into the sport. But, you know, along with that big rush of money comes a balance in the power, because now they have a say in a lot of things about the World Cup and about other events and how they look and where they're held and all kinds of other questions about them. And then a few years later, the other big thing happens, which is that the technology for television improves for broadcasting and transmission. And now you can have live simultaneous broadcasts in color of soccer matches all over the world. And so the whole world can watch, the 1978, but particularly 1982 World Cup from their living rooms. And then big money starts coming in from TV contracts. You know, everyone wants the rights to the World Cup and other events, and huge amounts of money start coming in that way. And so FIFA, which was kind of living on a shoestring, suddenly becomes an organization that has money, you know, coming out of its ears. And that's good in the sense that it did bring the sport to a lot of places it had never been. And great swaths of the world get access to the sport, get money to develop the sport, and that's all wonderful. But also, along with it came this corruption that I referred to. I mean, one of the things that happens is early on, the people who are brokering these deals, the middlemen, between the corporations and the broadcasters are realizing that they, you know, they don't want to share this incredible market with anyone else. They want it all themselves. And the way they can do that is to pay bribes. And so all the way back to 1978, there are discussions about how they can bribe the highest FIFA officials to ensure that they will only sell the rights to certain people. And the people I interviewed for this book told me stories about conversations they had in 1978 about whether Avalon should be receiving a salary or whether he should not. And the thinking was, ultimately, the decision was, let's argue that he shouldn't get a salary, that he should be unpaid. And the reason for that is because if he gets a salary, then he'll have some kind of financial independence and won't be beholden to sponsors and to broadcasters, etc. And instead, if he needs money, what we should do is pay him a bribe under the table. And that way, he'll kind of belong to us. When he takes the bribe, it'll be an illicit act. He'll be happy because he needs the money, but he'll also be beholden to us. He won't be able to tell anyone, and he'll feel that he has to continue to work with us and nobody else. That's the genesis of it. And we mentioned Sepp Blatter. He comes along. He's around at this time, but he's kind of a low-ranking official. He becomes general secretary of FIFA in, I think, 82 or 83, and then he becomes president of FIFA of 98. And what he does is he just sort of jumps on a fast-moving train and turns it into a bullet train. He takes a system that Avalanche put in place and grows the money much more, really expands the commercial possibilities of the sport, and also exploits what has become a patronage system within FIFA to ensure his own political success. And how does that work? Well, what FIFA does with all this money that comes in, a big chunk of it, is distribute it to all the soccer federations in every country. FIFA, since Blatter took over in 98, has been handing out annual distributions distributions of the money that comes in from all the World Cup and other revenue. They distribute it to all of these countries. Well, if it's a big national association like Germany or France or Brazil, the money, you know, a couple $100,000 every year, sure, $1 million every 4 years is almost meaningless, right? But imagine all these smaller countries that I was mentioning. You know, if you're the Seychelles football association.
Montserrat. Vanuatu, as you mentioned. Yeah.
Right. I mean, first of all, it's questionable how much national interest there is in the sport in those kind of countries, or how much oversight. If you're the president of the Vanuatu Football Association, there may be nobody who even cares about what you do, and people don't even realize it. And if $250,000 comes in the door every year, you know, It's there's a real question about whether any of that goes to the actual sport, as opposed to paying that guy's mortgage or whatever else he might want. And so that patronage system is extremely popular, became extremely popular with soccer officials, and ensured that people like Blatter stayed in power and gave them every incentive to continue it and to look for more money.
I'm looking at the chart on page 11, that's got all the federations, and it's got CONCACAF and CONMEBOL and all that. And so under CONCACAF, you know, you've got 41 member associations. So effectively, that means 41 votes, right, for the president of FIFA, and the same with, you know, with all of these, right? So, and it's one vote. So Vanuatu's got one vote, as does Brazil, right? As does Germany.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's right. So they're all equal in that regard. And, you know, we love the idea of democracy. That seems like a good idea, but it seems might be a good example of how unchecked democracy can also be problematic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone gets the same vote, but the problem is that not everyone has the same skin in the game, right? Mm-hmm. Brazil, who I mentioned before, or Germany have a huge amount of skin in the game, right? I mean, they care a lot about the World Cup. They care a lot about how it's put together. They care a lot about the general integrity of the sport because they have really good teams, and they want their teams to do well and win prestigious tournaments. I mean, sure, Germany is now out of this World Cup, but they still care a lot about it.
Yeah.
But Vanuatu, who we are really using as a whipping boy in this conversation.
apologies to anyone from Vanuatu listening.
Or let's pick a new one. Let's say Suriname.
Yes.
These countries, you know, have no expectation of ever qualifying for a World Cup, let alone, you know, winning one. So it doesn't really matter that much to them whether people think the tournament is clean or not. But, you know, making sure they get as much money as possible definitely matters to them. Mm-hmm. And so there you have sort of divergent interests. The Venn diagram of the interests of those associations and the good of soccer are, they don't overlap very much.
Right. So all of these federations, they deliver votes to whoever is at the top of FIFA, and those votes are, they go to who becomes the president. They also go to votes to determine who hosts the World Cup.
That's right. They do now. They didn't always. Yeah. So to clarify, you know, some of the problems we're seeing now in terms of whether the World Cup setting was done fairly or not came in under a different voting system in which the Congress, which is the full FIFA membership, would vote for certain things, would vote for who's the president principally, and for changes to the bylaws and that sort of thing.
Right.
But the site of the World Cup and most of the major economic decisions were being made by the executive committee, which was an elite committee of FIFA of 24 people who controlled the sport at the highest level. There was so many scandals about what the executive committee was up to and the sort of rampant corruption when it came to their votes, that finally FIFA decided to change it and take that power out of their hands. And they enlarged the executive committee, made it an executive council, mm-hmm. but they also gave the vote on where the World Cup would be cited to the full membership, the full Congress of FIFA. We saw the fruit of that most recently on June 13th in Moscow, when the full FIFA membership voted about where the 2026 World Cup would be. And that membership chose fairly strongly to vote in favor of United bid, which was United States, Canada, and Mexico over Morocco. So
right.
That was the first test of a full membership vote.
Okay, so there are some changes afoot, which we will get into in a moment. But effectively, you have an organization that sells these rights to broadcast the games and the tournaments, that gets income from bids for these tournaments, and with a lack of transparency, then is able to distribute those to different federations in exchange for votes. And there's a point that you describe about the investigation, which I want to get into now, is like a triangle. And the investigation is led by this Mike Gaeta, right? Is that how if I pronounce that correctly?
Mike Gaeta is the guy who starts the investigation.
Who investigated the mafia and organized crime. And it basically, he says that it looks exactly the same. FIFA looks exactly like a mafia type of organization.
To clarify, so Gaeta does open the case he's an FBI agent, and he gets a tip in 2010 and opens the case based on the tip. But the way these criminal investigations work in the U.S. system is that that you need a prosecutor, and it's when Gaeta goes to look for a prosecutor to shepherd this case. He finds a prosecutor in Brooklyn in the Eastern District in New York, which is one of 93 federal districts in the country. And that prosecutor is interested in the case, and that guy has a background in busting Italian mafia and other things in Brooklyn. And he's the one who sort of, after talking to a lot of people, learning a lot about the case, begins to understand it as a mafia organization.
Mm-hmm. And how did the U.S. get involved in investigating FIFA in the first place? What were the triggers there?
So it's an interesting story, and one that sort of talks on world politics, gets to world politics and that sort of thing. There's a... this FBI agent we discussed is sort of he leads a squad of agents who focus on organized Russian organized crime, and he is looking for what is being called transnational organized crime or transnational financial crimes, because under the leadership of Robert Mueller, who at the time was the FBI director, the FBI was interested in international crimes. And what it considered to be things that could lead to terrorism financing, and money laundering was considered particularly troublesome topic area they wanted to go after. So this FBI agent is looking around for cases. He's actually helping develop a case that's already in process that involves a illegal sports book and poker room that's being run in all places, of all places, the Trump Tower. But the head of that that illegal gambling operation is a Russian based in Russia, hasn't left Russia for many years. And so this FBI agent travels to London because he wants to gather information about that case. The reason he goes to London is because London has a huge Russian, or the UK has a huge Russian community, and many of the people with a lot of expertise about Russia, academics, former spies, law enforcement, consultants, all kinds of experts, policy people are based in London. So he goes to London to meet with a lot of people, learn as much as he can about Russia and also about this specific person. And while he's there, he's introduced to a fellow who had been in the MI6, which is the spy, international spy agency, sort of the closest equivalent you could have in the UK to the CIA. He'd been an agent for the MI6 for many years and was a specialist in Russia. And this agent's, this former MI6 agent's name is Christopher Steele. At the time, Christopher Steele was not a well-known figure, not a household name by any means. Of course, in the past year and a half, he's become uber famous for his for the Trump dossier that he compiled and that has now sort of circulated at the highest levels of the U.S. government. At the time, though, he was not well known, but he wasn't a really credible expert on Russia. And he talks to this FBI agent about the case that he's investigating, and they leave off with the idea that if Steele comes across other interesting cases, he'll be in touch. Well, it so happened that within a few months, Steele starts getting his radar up about something else. Steele hit one of his first clients in his new business, which is a corporate intelligence business. One of his first clients was England. England hired him. The English bid for the World Cup, because they were trying to win the rights to host the 2018 World Cup. That bid hired him and other people to do research about competitors and about what the and about FIFA and everything they could think of to try to increase their chances of winning the right to host the World Cup. And Steele, since his specialty was Russia, was particularly focusing on what Russia was up to. So in the early parts of 2010, he starts hearing rumors from his sources that Russia is up to no good, that Russia is doing whatever it can to win the World Cup, including subterfuge, potential bribery, vote swapping, all kinds of things that are not only prohibited by FIFA, but might actually, in some cases, constitute fraud and or money laundering and break all kinds of laws. And so he contacts the FBI agent again, Mike Gaeta, and says to him, hey, why don't you come back to London? Why don't you come back to London? I have a tip for you. And so Gaeta goes back to London, and at this point, Steele tells him about what he's finding out about Russia and FIFA. And Gaeta hadn't really even heard of FIFA, but it all sounds very interesting to him. And so he goes back to New York and opens this case and gets his prosecutor to sign on as well, and they're off to the races. That's the origin of it. It's really interesting because, in a sense, this is this becomes a critical moment in building the relationship between Steele and the FBI, right? And without this case, it's very likely that Steele doesn't really have any kind of relationship of trust with the FBI. And when he produces his much more famous dossier, he's got the FIFA dossier, now he has the Trump dossier. When he produces the much more famous Trump dossier, he's able to give it to the FBI and they take it credibly. It's very likely that if they didn't have that existing relationship, and if the FIFA case hadn't been so successful for the DOJ, that the FBI might not have taken that dossier very seriously, because, you know, people send all kinds of crazy tips and stories to the FBI all the time. There's conspiracy theorists all over the place, and most of that stuff they don't take seriously because they have to consider the source. Well, in this case, they consider the source, and the source was of the highest level of credibility for them. And so, you know, I think it's not really a stretch to say that without the FIFA case, the whole Trump-Mueller investigation would be in an extremely different place. I think it's sort of a fascinating and crazy secondary effect of the FIFA investigation.
Absolutely. It's super fascinating. And do you think that, so in your view and what you witnessed in pulling this book together, that this was it fit the categories of under this law called RICO, and it was there were very much legal grounds versus a kind of political, because the Russians would say, for example, that this is all just the U.S. trying to get back at FIFA for not being able to host the World Cup.
Yeah, that's in fact what lots of people in FIFA say. No less than Sepp Blatter, the former president of FIFA, told me that personally. This whole investigation is sour grapes, right? This whole investigation is the U.S. is bitter because they weren't selected to host the 2022 World Cup, but Qatar was. It's important to clarify that the same day that FIFA voted to host the 2018 World Cup and picked Russia over England, the same people in that room in Zurich picked Qatar over the U.S. and other bidders. But that story is not true. And, what I just told you, the story of how this investigation started kind of gives lie to that story, because this conversation that Christopher Steele and Mike Gaeta are having, at least opening the case, occurred in July 2010, which was 5 months before FIFA voted on where the World Cups would be held. The U.S. in July 2010 still believed that it was going to win. It was still very optimistic that it was going to carry the day. And it doesn't make sense from a chronological point of view that this would be a sour grape story if that investigation was already started before the vote. Simply put, it also doesn't make sense that the investigation, if it were a case of sour, if it were sour grapes, that it would be run by a Russian crime unit out of New York rather than some sort of political corruption or Middle East corruption group out of D.C. It just doesn't. It's a nice narrative, but it's an untrue narrative. The truth is, this case was already up and running long before the U.S. ever lost that vote.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really comes across in your book is how, well, to me anyway, how in some the names change, particularly in CONCACAF, but the practices continue. And when you talk about Jack Warner and then Webb, Jeffrey Webb, the continuity and even the scale of it going up. And then for me, what that says is, well, that there's something wrong with the rules that people are playing with if you swap across the names, but the same practices appear to continue and continue and continue.
I think this is something the prosecutors talked about at length in their indictments. The idea that by getting rid of one corrupt official, you're only sort of clearing the way for another corrupt official to come along. I think that's kind of one of the characteristics of this kind of corrupt organization. What they consider to be criminal enterprise is the idea that these aren't lone actors, but you have an institution that is oriented towards corruption, and therefore the people who run it are acting with the complicity of everyone around them, and if you take them out, someone will step in. We've seen that, we see that all the time with sort of narco cartels, right? I mean, it's great to knock off the head, but as long as there's a business, more people are going to step in to run it. Now, narco cartels or Italian mafia in Brooklyn are run, it's sort of the fundamental thing they do is by definition criminal. And one would like to hope, and I think the prosecutors in this case felt that way, that the fundamental thing FIFA does, which is run world soccer, is not criminal, but soccer is a good thing. And so it's a little bit tricky. You don't want to sort of say the entire sport is by definition corrupt, rather that the management of it has been corrupted. And so the goal, instead of dismantling all that, is to find some way to change it so that there's a cleaner culture. It's kind of a much more difficult dance, in a sense, than just dismantling the whole thing. But it is a stubborn problem. I mean, in CONCACAF, which is the confederation that runs North and Central America and the Caribbean, you had three successive presidents, three generations of leadership, all indicted for corruption, right? In South America, you also had three successive presidents in their confederation indicted for corruption. And in each successive generation, comes in and sings their own praises and says they're the clean ones. But, you know, it turns out that they're sort of like protesting too much. So history has shown the loudest voices within the sport criticizing the corruption tend to be the people who are the most corrupt. So, you know, it has been an ongoing problem. And, you know, I think it's because it's such easy money for these people to get. It's so easy for them to skim money out of the sport. And there's been so few checks on their corruption over the years.
What role do you think the different sponsors have to play in this? If you're a Coca-Cola, if you're an Adidas, what role should they be doing that differently perhaps?
Well, I mean, I'm a bit cynical about sponsors. You know, mm-hmm. I think they're in it. They're not in it because they love the sport or anything in it else. They're in it because they love, right, you know, money. And I think they stick with something like FIFA for as long as it they feel like it doesn't hurt their image or their bottom line. Yeah. So what we saw is that the sponsors didn't say very much about the sport until bad news started coming in about it, right? And so they weren't there looking at the books of FIFA and with blowing the whistle. But then when the DOJ comes in and gets all these people arrested and indicts all these people, suddenly they're indignant and outraged and they want out, and many of them abandoned FIFA at that point. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess it's good they got out to send the message, but, you know, one wonders what were they doing pouring all this money into it for decades without a word being said. And I suppose that's not surprising, but it is dispiriting.
I'm not sure if it was you that tweeted this, but I recall, so there's a photograph, I think it was 1974, it was Johan Cruyff, and on his Dutch uniform, he's got two stripes, whereas everyone else has got threes. He took a stand against this, and it just struck me as being very as being quite symbolic of that, you know, the turning point in that era. And of course, you know, no player would be able to do that now.
I'm not sure they wouldn't be able to do it. Like, you could sort of imagine someone like a Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo are could be incredibly powerful, because, you know, it's hard to imagine anyone wanting to get in the way of public figures with that much, that much of a large fan base. But at the same time, the whole concept of athletes who speak out, or athletes who make a point, has really been, you know, neutered completely. We just don't see it. We don't see very much of that in sport at all. In the U.S., we've seen in the National Football League, players who stand out about political issues get severely castigated in the sport and get, in some cases, pushed out, you know. And I think that message bounces around in all sports, and athletes believe it's in their best interest to keep their head down and their mouth shut, and they just have too much financial interests at play to want to risk it. It takes a very rare athlete to stand up these days.
Very, very true. The Colin Kaepernick example that you talk about is very, very clear and stark. It would appear if you're an athlete and you want to speak out.
I mean, it's chilling, right, for athletes. You know, if you want to stand out, the answer is, you know, if you want to speak out, just know
sponsorships
that
go away. Yeah,
you may never work again, right? Yeah. So that's a scary thing. It affects your livelihood. We think of athletes as something, you know, bigger than just regular people, but in the end, they have bills to pay too, and they don't want to lose. They don't want to lose that. And so, if we think about my job or your job, if my boss said to me, "I'll fire you if you say something," I'd think 2, 3, 4 times before I say it.
Yeah. And we have arguably longer careers, right, in what we do. So,
not everyone can
be a Lionel Messi and make $100 million a year or whatever. But most footballers are, they don't make quite as much.
That's right. That's exactly right. So I think it's very, we're not likely to see people, we're not likely to see change coming from athletes. And one of the things that struck me reporting this book was how on the margin athletes are. I mean, there are a few former players who have become administrators of football or soccer and have become really corrupt. But when players are still playing, no one who runs a sport seems to even think about them. They're just secondary to the whole thing. And I think that to me that's really telling, because what the audience, the worldwide audience that is obsessed with the sport, is thinking about is the guys in the field, is the Messis and the Ronaldos and all the other stars, and they're not interested, you know, in the guys running the sport. And it's funny, it's just a weird duality. The guys running the sport probably like it that way because they can stay in the shadows and get all their money and live this incredible first class lifestyle, which really is quite spectacular. Without you know, the fans really being any the wiser, because they're thinking about, as they should, right, about the players. You know, so
I guess unless you're a Sepp Blatter and commission a movie with Tim Roth as the lead.
Funny. I've seen that movie. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. And no one, I'm one of the very few people in the world who ever saw it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they spent a lot of money making it, but no one watched it. And so Sepp Blatter, if he wanted to become a big international superstar, that didn't work, right? People still aren't interested. They aren't interested in his story so much as they are in what happens in the field.
Yeah. Ken, I want to get into how you did this, how you researched this book, because it's so thoroughly researched. And you must have talked to so many people. And I want to get into that a little bit. How did you pull this together, both in terms of knowing, you know, the conversations with Sepp Blatter, what was going on in the investigation? You know, it's as if you were a fly on the wall throughout this process, and I want to understand that a little bit better.
Well, it was a long and hard process. Mm-hmm. I was actually watching a World Cup game yesterday with someone who's been covering it for much longer than me, knows a lot more about it, but who I've been in touch with since I started this process, and he said to me, it's kind of remarkable how much you've learned in the time you've been covering this, because when you started, you didn't know anything. And it's true. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, covering sports is not my main focus. I do it occasionally, but I don't pretend to be a sports reporter, and I certainly am not a FIFA reporter. And so when I agreed to do this, very quickly it became apparent to me that I was in over my head. There was a heck of a lot to know about this sport. Decades of history to absorb, and a lot of people I'd have to meet before I'd even begin to understand it. And I spent probably the first basically a year reporting the sport, just kind of thrashing about in the wilderness, trying to understand what it is I was looking at. Right, I traveled to Europe and to South America and to New York and all over the place, begging first to just get in the room with people so they would talk to me, and then learning what questions to ask that made any sense, that gave me any kind of degree of credibility among what is a fairly specific audience with a very specific history. And, you know, some of these people weren't very forgiving, because it's not like I was asking questions about something that had never been talked about before. I mean, I'm sitting down with FIFA officials thinking they've done a million interviews, and this guy comes in, doesn't know anything, and it's all out there. And so I had to ask patience of a lot of people, to give me the time to understand it and to sort of wrap my head around it. And over time, I think the knowledge base I built and spending a lot of time researching things that didn't even end up in the book helped me get the fluency to be able to know what I was asking about finally. So that was a huge help, but it was a long sort of painful process. I mean, it was one of these things where it's like there's no shortcuts. I couldn't fake it. Knowing anyone could see through any attempts to fake it, and so I had to essentially to really absorb the material. And the next thing was, you know, what I sort of think as the last guy at the bar phenomenon. If you wait around long enough, and no one else is still waiting to get the interview, to get the information, you might get lucky. I think that was certainly the case with me with some sourcing questions, because sourcing was such a challenge and so few people wanted to talk to me, between soccer officials who were terrified of that they could be the next person indicted, and law enforcement officials who aren't supposed to be talking about a still ongoing case. I just had real difficulty getting information from insiders. And I began to get breakthroughs in that really in the late 2016, early 2017 period. And until then, it was a lot of swings and misses. So that was the reporting process, was just beating on door after door after door. And also, I would say, going to Miami constantly, because it turns out that Miami is a huge locus of of soccer activity, but also of corruption. There's just, frankly, a ton dirty deeds happening in Miami all the time. So,
did at any point did you think there's no book here? This I'm just not getting anywhere.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. Right. I definitely thought that. I mean, you know, I wrote 100 pages of a first draft that I ultimately threw out completely. It was all about other stuff, and it was all about ancient history, and you know, it was chapter one of the book was sort of Buenos Aires 1978 and all this stuff about the dictatorship in Argentina and about these generals in the dictatorship and these admirals in the dictatorship who were doing all kinds of skullduggery behind the scenes with each other that was only tangentially related to soccer and certainly seemed to bear only a very distant, if at all, relationship to what was happening in the criminal investigation the U.S. undertook. I wrote those 100 pages because I didn't know what else to write because it didn't have the sourcing. And I would sort of sit there and talk to my colleagues at BuzzFeed where I work or talk to my very sweet and supportive wife and say, what am I doing? This is going to expose me as really like a big faker. And so that was a trying and terrifying experience, to be honest. And I'm really lucky that I got both the support of my family and colleagues and also my publisher and employer to give me the time and space to fight through that and actually find the story.
Was it a question of allowing or waiting for some of these sources to start to come to you because they started to trust you and then it built from there? Was a bit like that, or what were some of the, was there a turning point? Was there an event?
I don't think there was an event. I don't know what it was. It was one of those things that just sort of slowly builds its own quiet momentum. And I was able to, I mean, perhaps word got around certainly people in the world of soccer knew that I was asking questions. I was working on the book. I'd sent out 8 billion emails to people and phone calls and WhatsApp messages and Facebook messages and anything I could to get in front of people's faces. And then, so the word had gotten out and I was getting to the point where people were, they would say, oh yeah, I know who you are. Or even I was wondering when you might call. That started to happen.
Right,
so
right.
That might have helped. Certainly that might have been a sign to people that this guy is more credible. And you know, also I think as time went on, people with knowledge of the case also, you know, felt a little less nervous about talking, still with all kinds of rules about being, you know, about anonymity and being quiet about what was going on. But there was some more openness to the idea.
Sure. Was there anything that surprised you when in pulling this together that you didn't really expect at all?
In terms of reporting?
Things that you found out. Things that this like, whoa, this was, did not expect that. You know, anything, was it the opulence of Chuck Blazer, although you were looking at the guy for a while?
A surprise because I'd done the previous coverage.
Yeah.
But you know, I think there was moments of surprise when there were sort of individual acts of corruption that you just couldn't believe that it would reach that level. One example I've been citing is that it's not in the book, but we learned earlier this year that Costa Rica, which wears New Balance uniforms in the national team, they used to wear, I think, Lotto, might have been Umbro, but I'm pretty sure it was Lotto, and they switched. And the reason it turns out they switched is because a Panamanian broker was bribing the president of Costa Rica's soccer federation $500,000 to switch from one to the other.
I thought that was cool that they were using New Balance. I thought, that's unique and you know. Okay.
Well, so there you go. That's the answer. The answer is because there was a bribe behind it.
Right now,
it's not entirely clear that New Balance was aware that this was happening. Mm-hmm. You know, New Balance has some degree of plausible deniability on this issue. Mm-hmm. But it's just those kind of petty pieces of corruption were stark reminders of how sort of screwy the sport is. So there was that. I mean, there was also surprises in terms of people sharing tidbits about the investigation that had never come out before that I found pretty startling. Some of the tactics and techniques by the FBI and the IRS to get people to cooperate were pretty pretty intense and pretty, pretty not exactly the gentlest or kindest way to do things, but fairly effective. And so that was those were kind of revelations. Just the inner workings of a case and what they can do to people's lives was pretty impressive. I've come away from this with a new understanding of how powerful federal prosecutions really are.
No, could be ominous. We're halfway through Russia 2018. What are you looking out for in Russia that interests you, given everything that you've researched and given your book?
Well, look, I don't think we'll ever really know, or we're very unlikely to know whatever happened with Russia's bid to get the World Cup. One wild anecdote out of all this is that after Russia and Qatar awarded the World Cups, the two countries that on paper are least prepared to host World Cups, FIFA orders, under a lot of public outrage and pressure, orders its own audit type investigation of the two of all the bids for the World Cups in those rounds. They hire a former American federal prosecutor by the name of Michael Garcia, who was then at a law firm in the States, to run an investigation. He travels all around the world doing this investigation, and when it finally comes out, Russia is absolved of any wrongdoing. But if you read what they did with Russia, you have serious questions, because it turns out that when investigators went to Russia to look at their books, to look at their records and understand what they did, the Russian bid team informed them that the computers they had used to run the bid had been leased computers, and that immediately after the bidding was completed, they returned the leased computers to the group that leased them to them. Well, that was a soccer foundation that was closely linked to one of Putin's best friends, the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich. And the first thing that soccer foundation did was to destroy all the computers and all the information they contained. So FIFA decided to give Russia a clean bill of health based on zero evidence, because there's no evidence. There's no information whatsoever about what would happen. Who knows what happened? It's all destroyed, right? I guess it's possible that that Department of Justice might have some information they've never put in public about what Russia did. But as far as FIFA goes, we're never going to hear anything, I don't think. So now Russia has its World Cup. Vladimir Putin has the World Cup he wanted, and I think he's making it very much his party, right? He's at the opening ceremony, of course, but a week later he's inviting Sepp Blatter to come be his guest of honor at the World Cup too, which is a kind of a aggressive, I think, political statement, because Sepp Blatter, after the U.S. case broke open, although he was never indicted by the U.S., was pressured to resign, which he did, and then he was put under criminal investigation in Switzerland, and then FIFA itself banned him, the ethics committee banned him from the sport, and he's currently banned for 6 years from the sport, which means effectively he shouldn't be going to any FIFA events. But Putin obviously does things his own way and doesn't really care what other people say, and he decided to invite Blatter anyway. He said, I don't care what FIFA says, you're my guest of honor. Blatter, who is a guy who's got his entire self-image wrapped up in running the sport or being involved in the sport, was all too happy to accept the invite. And he's been running around Russia for the last week or so. And he attended a couple of matches, and it's all very much sort of Putin thumbing his nose both at FIFA and the West. I think it's, you could say it's not a particularly gracious way to proceed. FIFA awarded the World Cup to Russia, which they so wanted, and in response, Putin is thumbing his nose at FIFA. There's the irony in the fact that Infantino, who is the new president of FIFA, would never have the job if not for the fact that Russia was probably acting, was definitely acting in a suspicious way back in 2010. If you follow the history, right, Russia was doing something shady, potentially to win the World Cup. This alerts Christopher Steele, which sparks his massive criminal investigation, which, among other things, leads to the downfall of Sepp Blatter. And that allows Infantino, who never was going to be president of FIFA, to become president of FIFA, because so many other people fell. It opened a otherwise impossible path to his presidency. So you have this guy who is in that position because essentially of Putin's questionable acts years earlier, sitting beside Putin at the opening of the World Cup. And then a week later, Putin is hanging out with his predecessor. It's all, it all sort of, you know, it's the kind of stuff that guys with push pins, cork boards, and red string love to theorize about in their basement, but it's actually happening, right? And I mean, today's news, the most recent news I found fascinating was that now Putin and Donald Trump are going to have a summit, and that summit is going to take place in Helsinki on July 16th, which is the day after the World Cup final. The World Cup final is July 15th. The following day, these two guys are going to meet, and I can only take that as another PR victory for Putin.
Absolutely.
Right? The World Cup, the World Cup is his big party, and then the next day he gets to show the whole rest of the world that he can get the U.S. to meet with him and give him an opportunity to loudly say that Russia's wonderful and never done anything wrong.
The parallels to the athletics doping case, the Sochi incident, and what came out of the Icarus documentary are pretty chilling to me. They're you know, because that followed. Putin, you know, took that as the go ahead to invade Crimea and to, you know, do all kinds of things, and the geopolitical consequences of all of that starts to boggle the mind a little bit and be a little bit frightening. And maybe, you know, maybe there isn't as much to this, but it certainly. I mean, have you seen Icarus? Have you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Actually, I just had lunch with the director of Icarus.
Oh, right.
Icarus
okay.
The other day.
Yeah. What? I mean, what do you think about the parallels to what happened in the investigation and now the World Cup and what could happen post the 2018. I know you talked a little bit about this, and I know it's a bit speculative, but you know, wondering what other thoughts you have about that.
You know, I don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, you know, I mean, will FIFA clean itself up? Will it continue on the path of being cleaner? Maybe. I mean, maybe, you know, there's sort of this idea of governance that, you know, being transparent can actually be a better business model. And so that if FIFA really wants to make a lot of money, it should be a more transparent and less corrupt organization. And then, you know, following in the footsteps of something like the National Football League or something, which has its own problems, but of a different nature, and it certainly knows how to make money, FIFA could, you know, find a cleaner future and a much richer future if it's willing to do that. And then, you know, parallel to that is the ongoing criminal investigation in the U.S. and other countries. And, you know, I mean, it's the U.S., when it does those kind of international corruption cases, part of the thinking of the DOJ is that they not only want to build the best case they can, but they also want to spur other countries into action. And that's something we saw the DOJ do with some of the crackdowns on Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA stuff, where they try to get other countries to do their own stuff. You know, we've seen that, for example, I think Odebrecht, which is a good example of that. The U.S. DOJ was part of a huge settlement with Odebrecht in that case, and now, you know, it's continuing to make massive news in other countries. And in the case of the FIFA case, after the U.S. does this, we see cases opening in Switzerland, France, Germany, Spain, Uruguay, Peru, Australia. There's all these countries around the world that are opening their own parallel or copycat type investigations. And so those are going to help, hopefully, bring out more of the rot and clean things up. And you know, maybe we'll see more shoes drop in the U.S. case as well.
How do you think we'll know that FIFA truly is a cleaner organization?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's sort of like, I think the idea that it would be totally clean is kind of optimistic. Yeah. You know, it's just any organization that has 211 members, you know, significantly more than the United Nations, it literally touches almost every single country by any definition in the world. It's impossible, I think, to avoid some illicit acts. And it's important to understand that not every country has the same kind of concepts of cleanliness and non-corrupt behavior as we might in the U.S. or in the West. And I do think there can be a great reduction of it. And I think, you know, we'll see when all the dust settles in something like the bidding process for the 2026 World Cup, which, you know, just concluded. You know, we'll see audits of those kind of things down the road, and we'll see if any accusations of dirtiness come up. I think that the geopolitical role of FIFA is, if anything, stronger than ever. And, you know, I think that's in a sense a shame, because I think it clouds our understanding of what's good about the sport. And one of the things I'm hearing a lot these days is whether Qatar, you know, could have the World Cup stripped from it, or mm-hmm. be forced to share it with neighboring countries, right? Well, mm-hmm. Qatar is in this dispute with the Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
They're not very well liked in the region, are they?
Right. And so these other countries are, you know, having a giant PR shouting match with each other about each other, and they're holding conferences and running kind of black ops to undermine each other publicly. And they're using, you know, their issues have really nothing to do with soccer.
Yeah.
But these countries are using soccer as sort of a bludgeon and an arguing point in the whole thing, right?
You know. Yeah, it's inescapable, because it's, you know, it's geopolitics, and it gets into the Olympics, into football. But at the other end, and this is the question I wanted to ask you as well, is, you know, you've got people like you and I who like the sport, love the sport, people who are listening who maybe play the sport. Fundamental question I have is it still okay to watch the World Cup in Russia? Are we perpetuating this?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. I mean, this is one of the great, uncomfortable features of the whole thing, right? I mean, everyone at this point knows FIFA is corrupt. No one has any more illusions about it. And we all say it's disgusting, despicable, but then as soon as the whistle blows, everyone is watching, right? I mean, who doesn't? There's been some amazing matches. It's been, you know, I mean, Germany gets eliminated. Who would have predicted it? It's amazing. Yeah. It's what a storyline.
Lionel Messi scored one of the most beautiful goals I've seen he does it regularly, but, you know, just the other day, and, you know.
It makes it look easy, right?
Makes it look easy, and we love to appreciate that. It's artistry, and there's drama, and there's all this wonderful stuff going on. But part of me feels dirty for watching it.
are we participating in some kind of, like, you know, a war crime or something? And I don't know what to say about that. I mean, people just love the sport. They don't want to hear about the dirty side. They want to see the artistry and the beauty. I think, in a sense, the answer would be, maybe the true way to force reform at FIFA would for people to turn off the TV. Mm. But it doesn't happen. So if you want to turn it off in protest, I support you, brother. But I think that. I don't think that's going to be the winning route, because I just think there's too many people in the world who want to watch it. There's too much of a giant media machine, you know, pumping up people like Messi and Ronaldo and the other great players of the sport. And I think that we're going to have to find some other way to pressure them. And in that way, the criminal cases did something that the fans just weren't going to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a possibility that with the money getting, you know, ever greater in this sport, the World Cup getting ever bigger, more teams, and there could be an oversaturation of football, and you know, you start to, the quality goes down, and that's one way in which the things come back into the, you know, come back a little bit more sensibly, or no?
Yeah, that's right. So I think that you think about sort of tragic business stories about fashion brands and that
kind
of thing.
Where
they over license themselves, right? And pretty soon, you know, it's like, you know, baby bottles have the Polo logo on it or something. And you think, what has happened? And I think that's true, that FIFA could overdo it. You know, the expanding the World Cup to 48 teams is a clear money grab by FIFA. The idea is that it'll generate a lot more money, and the United bid promised something like $15 billion in estimated up to $15 billion in profits, and sort of guaranteed 11, and, you know, that's all sort of based on this 50% expansion in the size of the tournament. And so that's very attractive to FIFA, because it wants more money. It actually needs it now, because it's been running in the red since the criminal case broke open, thanks to the loss of sponsorships and the massive legal bills. But you're right. You're really running a risk of diluting it. I mean, there have been matches in this tournament where that are snoozers that no one wants to see, right? And if you think that these matches are dry now, imagine some of them, you know, with a much more watered down, you know, modeled down field. And I think you run, you do run a risk of losing interest. I was just thinking, you know, some of these matches have just not been very compelling. Well, what if it is sort of, you know, India versus Moldova? I don't know. I don't want to attack any of those countries, yeah. But I mean, countries that don't have really that great soccer. Yeah. You risk
10-0, you know, Brazil versus India or whatever. Ending 10-0 or something like that.
The match I was thinking about was today, and I don't know. I know this podcast might run later, so this may be dated. But
yeah.
Tunisia is playing Panama. Right, you know, right. two of the worst teams in the tournament, and
both eliminated.
Both already eliminated. Who wants to watch that match? Who's interested? Other than people in Tunisia and Panama, maybe not even them. So imagine a tournament with that many more teams. I think it's a big risk. And, you know, we've also been hearing stories about creating a club world, some kind of giant club World Cup that's much bigger than the current one, or some kind of, biannual sort of World Cup style competition. And, you know, you tire out the players, you overdo it, you make them do too many things, and you risk making the sport seem like a cheap throwaway. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really useful stuff. I want to wrap it up, but before I do, there's plans for a movie, right, in the works for Red Card.
Yeah, there was an op. So I was very lucky to not only get the book deal, but I also got an option to make a film. So Warner Brothers purchased the option for this. And it involved in the project also are a couple of production companies, including one run by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. So a really great group of people who are all, you know, looking for ways to turn this story into a movie. I think really, you know, I'm obviously very excited about that. But I think there's a lot of interest from people around the world to see that. A few weeks ago, I did a fun thing on Twitter where I did sort of a dream casting, imagining who could play the different FIFA officials, mm-hmm. and had a lot of fun doing that. And people mm-hmm. reacted really nicely to that. I had sort of in my head a bunch of ideas and put them out there. The one I got from sort of the football audience was Anthony Hopkins playing Sepp Blatter, which I thought was kind of an inspired choice. So that that was a lot of fun.
Who's the hero in the movie? In your view.
Yeah, well, thank you, because that's also touching on something I haven't really talked about in this conversation. You know, I think the hero probably is law enforcement. We'll see what happens, but I think, mm-hmm. you know, you have to, if you're going to do a cops versus robbers story, I think it's the cops. And the hero for me in that story, we talked about Mike Gaeta, but is another guy, the IRS agent named Steve Berryman. And Steve Berryman is an IRS agent based in Orange County, California, about as far from FIFA as you can kind of imagine. But he turns out to be not only one of the best IRS agents in the country, but also a committed soccer football fan who grew up a big chunk of his youth in England, loved the sport, and is a lifelong Liverpool supporter. So when he, in 2011, gets word that the FBI is digging into the sport, he leaps at the chance to get involved. And he finds a way, he basically argues his way into the case. He begs to be involved. Goes to New York and visits the prosecutors and sort of, you know, basically throws himself at their mercy, saying, please give me a chance to be involved in this case. And they love it because he's the guy who can trace the money. He has the skills they don't have. They know how to try to flip people and to get them to wear wires and that sort of stuff, but they don't really know that much about following money around the world, and that's really what's critical for this case. This case doesn't exist without someone who knows how to subpoena banks, to chase down bank account information, and to figure out how money moves from place to place to place, and prove that these were in fact bribes. And that's what Steve Berryman, who's an incredibly dedicated, focused guy, brings to the case. And really, you know, don't just trust me. Like, lots of people have called him the hero. In fact, after this big trial in November and December last year, which kind of was a major piece of the case and helped with the verdicts of the jury, helped sort of back up and prove the claims that the prosecutors have been making all along. One of the defense attorneys of a guy who was convicted went up to Berryman and gave him a hug, which is an unusual thing to do for a lawyer whose client is about to be sent to prison. But she gave him a hug and she told him that he made the whole case, and without him, that, you know, it never would have happened, and that she was very impressed with the work he had done.
That's awesome. That sounds like a great way to a great place to wrap it up. But was there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's pretty good. It's fun to talk about this, and I liked the conversation we had.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's a great book. It really is, and I really want to congratulate you. It's so well put together. It reads so well. I couldn't put it down. I read it in a day and a half. I'm going to recommend it to all my listeners, and so you should be very, very proud of it. It's great stuff. But before we go, last thing, where can people find you? Where can they find the book and anything that you wanted to call attention to?
Sure. So before anything else, I know that there's enormous controversy in the world about what the proper thing to call this sport is. So I often say soccer, but I sometimes say football. And for some people, that's fine. Other people, the word soccer is like fingernails on a chalkboard. For other people, the word football to refer to anything other than the sport with the oblong ball is also very wrong and insulting. So you really can't win in that debate. Yeah, and I tend to just be loose about it and not really pay attention to what I'm saying. So if I offend anyone, I apologize. And believe me, I love the sport with the bouncing ball. Maybe the easiest way is just called football, as they call it in Latin America. This book, Red Card, Speaking of Latin America, is available in a few different languages. It's available in the U.S. and in the U.K. With books with different covers, with different publishers. It's also available in all of Latin America as Tarjeta Roja, published by a publishing house based in Mexico. It's available in Brazil and Portugal under the title Cartão Vermelho, which just means red card. It's going to be available very soon in Dutch, in the Netherlands, and in Belgium, and after that in Italy and Japan as well. But currently you can get it on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble or at your local bookstore where it's being sold. It should be available. If you can't find it, hunt me down, because you can find me on Twitter at Ken Bensinger. That's KenBensinger. You can find me at Ken Bensinger on Twitter, and my direct messages are open, so feel free to DM me, and I do my best to respond to everyone with any questions you have about the book. The one thing I would supplicate from everyone, I really beg, is that everyone leave me, if they like the book, or even if they don't like the book, to leave me a review on Amazon or Goodreads, but particularly Amazon. Those are turn out to be really hard to come by. And it's enormously helpful to a book, to an author, to get that kind of feedback. It helps other people who are considering buying the book decide to buy the book. So please, if you like the book, leave me a review. If you don't like the book, find a nice thing to say about it, but leave me a review.
Yeah.
And I hope everyone gets a chance to read it.
Awesome. Ken, this was great. Thank you so much. Really appreciate this, and wish you all the best with future projects as well, and with the movie, and with the feedback. I'm sure you're going to get some great feedback across the world from people on Red Card. But thank you so much once again.
Thank you so much. Take care.
All right.
Bye, Nevin.
Bye. Wow. Right. I hope you found that as fascinating as I did, and if you did, do read the book. Red Card reads like a spy thriller, only, and sadly, it's true. I couldn't put it down. Check out the book, and if you enjoy the book, give it a review on Amazon, and also do reach out to Ken. And a little correction from my end, Johan Cruyff refused to wear the Adidas 3 stripes because he had a sponsorship agreement with Puma. Still, we love the Dutch legend, and he still exercised player power by refusing to participate in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. That is it for this week. As always, give us a review and a rating on iTunes if you enjoy the All Things Risk podcast. Tell your friends about the episode and the show, and subscribe if you have not yet done so. Allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, is the best place to do that. And please do that, because we have some great stuff coming up.
We'll be back soon. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.